Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Language rights have long been contentious issues in many countries, and the United States has not been immune to these conflicts, from English-only ballot initiatives in recent years to decades-long policies of forcing Indigenous Americans to drop their native tongue and speak English. If you look through our history, the idea of preserving language has been a major disruptive force in many countries. Look at the previous attempts in Quebec to break away over language issues. Even today, the dispute over Catalan in Spain is a major factor in breakaway attempts in Catalonia. My guest today is a University of Tulsa professor who has written extensively on language rights and governmental constitutions and statutes in Europe and the United States. Eduardo Feingold is a professor of Spanish and linguistics at the University of Tulsa and was recently named to an international advisory group that analyzes language policy and advises the UN on language minority rights and endangered languages. Dr. Feingold will be joining the Study Group on Language and the United Nations this year. He is a member of the International Academy of Linguistic Law and the International Society for Language Studies. He holds degrees from Tel Aviv University and the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Eduardo Feingold, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us, and congratulations on being named to the Study Group on Language in the United Nations. For those who are not familiar with this, what is this particular group?
This is a group of scholars who are interested or have a record of, significant research on language policy. Language policy is a very wide field, so there are people who study issues like education, and they're basically educational experts, and there are people who study organizations and the languages they choose. There are people who study endangered languages, languages which are disappearing, and they try to understand how to revive these languages. So, for example, you have Native American languages that are about to disappear, so we want to record them. We want to write grammars before they write dictionaries, if you don't have those, so you can, keep the language alive, teach it, revive it. So you have basically policy issues in mind, but most of us are interested in linguistics and some other field. In my case, I'm interested in the law, what constitutions and statutes say about which languages should be used in different settings. So in the United Nations, they have chosen certain languages for historical reason, mostly not for, pragmatic reasons, even though pragmatics has a place in the way they do it. But, there is no real system that is well thought. So this group wants to, give advice about, how they could improve their language policy.
And so you're advising how the United Nations works itself, as well as how it when it's working on international agreements between nations as well regarding language policy.
Correct. It's not only regarding language policy, but when they implement these agreements, they have to communicate between people. For example, I can tell you personally, in my case, I speak English fluently, but fluency is not the same thing that being native in a language. So when you speak a language and you're not native and you're speaking it to natives, you are at a disadvantage. So in many situations, English is being used to communicate with people who are fluent in English but may not understand everything, and puts them in a disadvantage.
Now, how does that work in what I would call officialese? When you're working on a major agreement, it's written in sort of official English as opposed to vernacular English, where I could say something is, oh, that's so cool. And you might say, if you're fluent but not necessarily a native, you might say, is he thinking about temperature? Is he thinking about something interesting? Or I could be saying it in an ironic sense, in which I'm saying, no, that is so bad.
Well, what they do when people meet, whether they're native speakers of English from different places or meeting with non-native speakers, what they do, they use a kind of, it's called a world English. A world English, what is known as world English, and there is something known as international Spanish, is basically what we linguists call a koiné. A koiné is when you basically take all the difference out and basically you iron the all these things that you are
the idiomatic
or regionalisms or colloquialisms, you won't use them.
Yeah.
That's what they do. So there is a, and also, you know, in a formal setting, like a meeting to discuss a treaty, people will revert to the kind of formal language you will read in, say, in the New York Times or Times Magazine, because as you know, the English language have no language academy.
Right.
So there is no reference to decide what, there is no really standard English. There is an agreement that you basically use what the New York Times or the or Time Magazine, that's the reference for the English language, as opposed to French or German or Spanish, which have academies of language, in which case, when there is an international agreement between Spanish speakers, the reference is going to be the Spanish Academy dictionary and grammar to what is the accepted way. But, you know, people use a formal English in a formal setting, and they iron out the things you mentioned.
Well, one of the things you're in studying language policy, you're looking at how individual governments treat their language issues. It's interesting that within the last decade or two, we've had all sorts of debates on whether to be in our official government usage of whether we're going to be helpful to bilingual speakers or to other languages, or we're going to have this English-only thing in the United States, and we're going to require everybody to use English. Are there other nations that go through the whole that same sort of issue?
There are nations who have approached this issue in the opposite way.
Mm-hmm.
They have decided, basically our neighbors in Canada have approach this in a different way because they have a different political setting. They have the issue of French in Quebec, where they have to basically give the language rights to the French speakers beyond what they had before and way beyond what Spanish speakers or any foreign language speakers have in the United States. And they went through a debate and they decided basically to spend money. Basically, everything about language policy boils down to who pays and how much.
Right.
Because language services are expensive. Translators are very expensive, whether it's in the court, whether it's in a, for a treaty. Bilingual teachers are hard to train, are hard to find, and they are more expensive. So it costs money, but it doesn't cost that much. The French have discovered that basically they have to spend something like what would look like huge sums of about like between 4 and 7%, I think. I'm not sure about the numbers, but I think that's a ballpark figure on bilingual education and bilingual services. But I would say the peace, that the social peace that this brought them, which had yielded results, economic results. Because if you have linguistic strife leads to not only political problems, but economic problems. As you know, from the recent terrorist attack in France, right? The terrorists came through Belgium, which has no government. Basically, because for the past few years, they have this conflict about language.
Right.
Okay. And they basically, because of, they are basically, the government is paralyzed because of ethnic reasons, because of the groups, you know, you have two major groups.
We're talking about Belgium here?
Belgium. I'm talking about Belgium.
Right, yeah.
So language, because it stands for a nation or for ethnic group, it can create major political problems, which can result in economic problems, in not being able to manage, you know, your police, your resources, and so on. So language policy people, they believe, and I'm a strong believer of this, having done this for the past 10 to 12 years, is that you have more to gain by investing in bilingual education and bilingual services in the courts, in the health system, than you have to lose. And
Now you were reciting the example of Canada earlier, where most people think of the conflict between most of the country English speakers and Quebec, which are French speakers. But in Canada, it's gone far beyond just that bilingual issue to native languages, indigenous languages in the Northwest,
right,
and also Asian languages along the Pacific Coast.
Right. We were talking about, my own field of research, which is how constitutions are being changed and adapted. When people realize that to solve a language conflict, you need to change your constitutions or your statutes. Canada very recently recognized their native people as one of the three original peoples, because until this change a few years ago, the original people of Canada were the French and English speakers. So they have changed their constitution to do that. So, South Africa, it did the same thing, immediately after the end of apartheid. It changed its language, its official language policy, changed its constitution to recognize 11 official languages instead of the two they had before, which were African and English. So now they have 11 official languages. Now, how that plays in real life is a different story.
Now, it seems to me when you have multiple languages as official, there's got to be one that sort of unites a people within a government.
Well, in practice, what happens, first, if you look at the United Nations, what is going on in the United Nations, you see that diplomats are always fluent in English. That's one of the main reasons why they are chosen by their own countries to be sent as diplomats. So for pragmatic reasons, for expediency, in order, say, maybe to talk faster, right, or get a deal signed faster, they do all the negotiations in English.
Now, I always heard French was the language of diplomacy. Is that no longer the case?
It's not no longer the case, no. No, actually, French became one of the second official language of the United Nations in 1945, because it was inherited from the League of Nations. The League of Nations in the First World War had French and English as their official and working languages. Now, at the time of the First World War, French was, would say, as much or perhaps more a language of diplomacy than English was. Mm-hmm. By the time the United Nations was created in 1945, that was no longer the case. But French remained an official language of the United Nations, because the official language of the United Nations at its creation were the languages of the victors in the Second World War, which brings us to a problem that German and Japanese are not official languages of the United Nations, while Spanish is.
Interesting.
Spanish is an official language of the United Nations because when the United Nations was created, the Spanish-speaking nations from Latin America were the majority of the languages in the United Nations. So English, French, add to it Spanish, and until 1968 when Russian was added as an official language, and 1972 when Chinese was added, and 1980 Arabic was added, then we get to the present situation. We had these six languages as the official language of the United Nations.
Yeah. My guest today is Eduardo Feingold. He is a specialist on government language policy. He's a professor of Spanish and linguistics at the University of Tulsa. He is joined as a permanent member of the Study Group on Language in the United Nations. It's an advisory group to the United Nations on language policy, both within the United Nations as well as looking at international agreements. And so you've sort of let out the contrast. There are some countries like the United States where the debate is whether to make the dominant language, the official language. There are other countries where there's been no question that the language of the country, say German and France, I think of those two countries in particular, where that language is the official language. Then you have all these other places where you have a mixture of indigenous peoples and they adopt multiple languages. Is there any difficulties in having multiple languages within a country? I mean, how do the countries, you mentioned South Africa, but India is another one where you have a tremendous number of language denoted as official, even though probably Hindi and English are used most.
Yeah, I studied mainly the United Kingdom, Spain, mm-hmm. South Africa, and the United States, and read something about India, work I hadn't done by myself. But what I see as a common thread between countries that have a successful language policy is that they have an official language for the country as a whole, like Spain. And then they have official languages that are co-official languages in the different states or regions.
So Barcelona.
So you have Catalan in Catalonia, which is official together with Castilian, the language of the major country. Then you have in the Cape province in Cape Town, you have the language called Hossa, as a click like that. And English, and then you go to Zululand, and it's Zulu, mm-hmm. and English and Afrikaans is there too, in some places more or less. So India has done the same. So you have the Hindi and English used all over India, and many of the Indian states have an official language for the state which is co-official. Yeah, Puerto Rico is working perfectly as an associated state of the United States with a constitution where English and Spanish are co-official languages. Mm-hmm. So you can reach an agreement there are pragmatic ways to address the needs of minorities. Certainly prohibiting, the use of minority languages leads to conflict. And, this goes all the way, you have examples in the Bible, you have examples, that where accents or, having different dialects lead to conflict. We, people in language policy, we have a consensus that we want to minimize conflict in the world that arises from language differences. Because the bottom line is that, it could be down to a money issue of, paying for language services.
Yeah. Now, does the United Nations have good policies in place on language accommodation?
What the United Nations has been doing very well is the issue of training diplomats. So they have a language training scheme that works for the 6 official languages. So let's say you are a diplomat and you speak, say, a certain one of the official languages, but you want to learn the other one, you want to learn Arabic or Russian or whatever, they are going to support you.
Mm.
So, and the other things that they have been moving into using technology, that's one thing, like online dictionaries, and certainly what changed everything is the use of the machines for simultaneous translation. So that it was discovered during the Nuremberg judgments when, IBM came up with the machine to do a simultaneous translation. So simultaneous translation works very well. And recently the United Nations have moved into a contract system to save money. Mm. So they pay for translators as is needed. And as you probably know, as English is becoming a global language and more people are fluent in it, English is becoming more central. Not only in the United Nations. Exactly the same thing is going on in the European Union. Yeah. I recently published a paper, showing that that's the trend in the European Union. It's a trend in South Africa too, and in India.
Mm. Now, your study group was also working on endangered languages.
Yes.
Give us a sense of some of the languages that are endangered. Are they endangered just by English encroaching on that language?
Not only English. Languages, there are in the world right now between 5,000 and 6,000 languages. And languages are like disappearing by dozens per year,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps more. The reason is that speakers of these languages are moving into speaking other languages. First, they become bilinguals, So most of the language, or many of the languages of the world, are in places like Africa and Australia. In Australia, there are hundreds of languages, which are disappearing very fast. Why? Because the speakers of those languages, first, they become bilingual in their language and English, and then their children, they become monolingual in English. So it's not because people are being, like, killed. No, we talk about, you know, language endangerment, or we linguists talk about language death.
Yeah.
But it's not because people are being killed for speaking a language.
Or being forced.
Even though that, or being forced, that happened in the past, for example, in Ireland, where Cromwell, you know, had like a death punishment for speaking Gaelic. So that's why Gaelic disappeared. It was basically killed. People were killed for speaking it. Or during Franco's dictatorship in Spain, where Catalan or the Maldon was prohibited in the public arena. So languages can be, right now, there are people being forced to stop using their languages. That's happening. Mm-hmm. But not by penalty of death or anything like that. The forces are mostly market forces. That, you know that you need to learn the local language, say, well, it's English or it's Portuguese in Africa or French in Haiti or whatever, and then, you know.
So what are the efforts to preserve these endangered languages? Is it a matter of getting the government of the area to...
The efforts to preserve a language is to go and record the last speakers. There are many languages in the world that have like 1, 2, 3, maybe 10, 20 speakers who are older, because we know when a language is going to die. A language dies when the young people and the children don't speak it anymore. So that's, we have a clear litmus test about the language slowly dying, when the people who speak it are old people and the young people don't speak the language. But you can reverse, and there are very successful cases of reversing language death or language endangerment by recording these old people or writing dictionaries, grammars, and then teaching the language to young people, teaching them about their ethnicity, right, their origins, you know.
We're seeing that a lot in Oklahoma, especially with all the gaming money that's come into a lot of tribes.
Right.
They're spending a lot of money on language preservation.
Right. Oklahoma is the right place to see this happening. Yeah. So, you know, we may see, and that's what we expect people who are interested in language endangerment, that they say Cherokee, you get more speakers, you may get more speakers of Cherokee in a few years than you had a few years ago.
Right.
Or not.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking of, say, a language like Comanche, which I know 10 or 15 years ago, it was down to about 10 or 15 people. And I think they have spent some money in trying to preserve Comanche to a younger generation. And it was like getting the elders to speak the language before it disappeared. It's sort of almost like a race against time.
Right. So the hearers won't think that what you do is just to start classes where you teach the language and so on. The way you do this is to put the young people in touch with the culture of the people who speak this language, because you cannot separate language from culture. Because we were saying earlier, you know, a language disappears when people go through assimilation to another culture, to going through cultural change. So basically, in order to revert language endangerment, you have to provide cultural opportunities to live a culture that, say, your parents or grandparents were natural, like live naturally in, mm-hmm. but you're not, right? So you have to...
Or you have to have at least that exposure to the culture.
Right.
So there's a reason for learning the language.
Right. Yeah. And you have to transmit kind of a pride in your culture. Because we, people who study this variety of languages in the world, we talk about ecolinguistics. So we see language as part of an ecosystem, in the sense that languages carry the cultural heritage and the cultural knowledge of a certain group. So when a language disappears, the culture disappears with it.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, though. Before we began talking, we were talking about Chicago and where really Chicago was the town of ethnic neighborhoods. That ethnic culture survives even if the language is dying out within those ethnic cultures.
That's true. But yeah. What you have to see is what aspects of the culture survive. You know, once the language disappears, right, what you may have is things, you know, usually things like food or some ethnic pride, right, mm-hmm. or things like that. These things, you know, like, you know, I'm Italian-American or American-Italian or something of that sort.
Yeah.
But the cultural traits, you know, had to do with being able to read the literature or talking to people in the old country or even watching a film.
Right.
And without having to read the subtitles, and as you know, with the subtitles, you lose all the nuances, you know, of the language, you know. And, you know, we were laughing a few days ago. You know, we saw this film, you know, the film of Borat, right? And they were going in a car, and they supposedly were speaking in Armenian, and they were speaking in Hebrew. They were saying, and Borat was saying something like, he said in Hebrew, which in Hebrew means, you make the omelette and I will take care of the wedding, right? So when people were like laughing in the theater of, you know, this guy is speaking this weird language, they thought it was Armenian,
uh-huh.
and, you know, the Borat, he's fluent in Hebrew,
right.
And then he was using Hebrew to do that. In the Israeli cinemas, where they showed this film, people were laughing like crazy. But I was sitting here in an American cinema, and my wife and I, we started laughing at that scene when everybody else was like, you know,
what's
what are these
on?
People laughing
right.
at? It was not a joke. It was like flat, you know, speech in Hebrew, where you should expect like Armenian. Something
right,
like that.
Right,
so,
right.
You know.
Well, we wish you great success with your work in the study group. Being an advisory group, I mean, do you come up with policies as far as the group?
We have a conference every year mm-hmm. where we meet and we organize the conference and we bring people, the experts, to speak about specific topics. And basically, we are expected to do what we do.
Yeah.
To publish in major journals and produce knowledge.
Well, we wish you great success with the study
Thank
group.
You. Thank you for having me.
Eduardo Feingold, thanks very much for joining us. Professor Eduardo Feingold is a specialist in government language policy and a professor of Spanish and linguistics at the University of Tulsa. He was recently asked to join an international advisory group, the Study Group on Language and the United Nations. He'll be joining the group in its first meetings in 2016. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.